You know, a couple of months ago, Lori and I went to visit our daughter, Carissa, and our son-in-law, Michael, back in Mississippi. And they live in a place where they like to not be in that place a lot. Meridian, Mississippi, pretty boring. And so they get out of town whenever they can. So while we were with them, we went down to Pensacola, Florida, for a couple of days. And we were going to spend a couple of days there at the beach. Well, you know, it's July. It's Florida. What you expect is hot, humid, sunny, pop-up thunderstorms in the afternoon that clear off, and it'll be great. Well, we got down there, and it wasn't that. It was raining cats and dogs, which really isn't great beach weather, generally speaking, you know. So the first day we were there, it just rained the whole day. That was okay. We went to the Naval Aviation Museum there at Pensacola, and that was really interesting. Second day we were there, sun came out, was glorious. We went to the beach and it was perfect beach day. You know, it just wasn't too hot. It was like 84 degrees and just really pleasant out on the beach. And the sand there is just gorgeous. Pensacola's white, powdery sand and the water's warm. And so we were having a great day. We were going to spend the whole day there. I'd been there about 3 hours and the breeze started kicking up a little bit, you know, and that was kind of nice, cool you off, but it just kept stiffening and kept getting stronger and stronger, and pretty soon it was starting to get a little bit unpleasant, you know, and it just kept getting stronger. Very unusual for that time of year there. And pretty soon we had this beach umbrella, you know, to stay in the shade a little bit, and the wind got so strong it actually turned it inside out. You know, and then it's knocking beach umbrellas over, and pretty soon we're seeing people's, you know, those little inflatable inner tubes are blowing down the beach, you know. And the next thing we know, we see boogie boards flying down the beach. It was getting so strong. And by this time now, the wind's starting to pick up the sand, and it's blowing across the beach, and you're essentially getting sandblasted, and it started to hurt. And we kind of said, you know, this is about enough of this. Forget this. You know, let's get out of here. And so we packed up our stuff and we're, you know, struggling through this now howling wind to the car. And we get to Michael's truck and these boogie boards come flying off the beach heading right for his truck. And so Michael, brand new truck, is there fending off boogie boards from slamming into his truck, you know. And so we're driving away and I'm thinking, you know, that's a lot like life. You think, here's what I want. I want a day at the beach. That's what I want for my life. Warm, sunny, nice, you know, water and just relaxing. And what so often happens is you get those periods where it's just like that, and then, man, the wind starts picking up, and the next thing you know, you're just getting blasted. And you're thinking, well, this is not pleasant. I didn't want this. Life just has a way of doing that sometimes. It's going to bring adversity to all of us, difficulty. We all know that. We've all experienced that. And so this morning, I want us, as we're thinking about some of the downsides of life, we've been thinking about things like dealing with disappointment and guilt and all of those sorts of things. I want us to think about adversity. And when you think about adversity and the Bible, who pops into your mind? Job. So we're going to look at just one verse, Job 13, 15. And it simply says this. This is Job, the words of Job. Though he, meaning God, slay me, yet I will hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face. Now, that one statement, though God slay me, I will hope in him, has a lot to say to us about dealing with adversity. So the first thing I think we need a little context in this, context is that Job was severely tested. We all know that. You know the story of Job. He experienced more pain than most of us could even imagine happening in life. Some of the things that I think we easily skip over, you know, he lost his wealth. Well, that's really a bad thing. You know, that would be truly upsetting for most people. But the thing that really gets me is all of his children died in one fell swoop. You know, Jill Briscoe, in her book, It Had to Be a Monday, wrote, "I know that in my experience, I do a halfway decent job of trusting the Lord, until something touches one of our children. In a way, our children are my Achilles heel, and Satan knows it. Most of us can relate to that. You know, yeah, we're going to deal with difficulties, but man, not my kids. Job had a parent's worst nightmare. All of his children died, and that was just part of the package. He lost everything. In Job 2:9, his wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." Now, that sounds really bad. You know, it makes Mrs. Job sound pretty crummy. It's like, well, thanks for your help. But I think we need to, it's not quite as bad as it sounds. You need to remember that that poor woman has suffered horribly. She has lost all of her children. Man, imagine what that was like. And now, what's happened in chapter 2 is her poor husband, whom she loves, has also become terribly ill. He's sick and miserable and suffering, and she thinks that the only way to end the misery for him is to curse God and as a result die. She thinks that's the only out is death for him. Now, you know, you think about, I don't know what kind of adversity you face in life, but I don't think there's any of us here who have faced the kind of adversity that Job felt. And you look at the horror of what happened in his life and you think, wow, was this, you know, because this guy was a bad dude and deserved it? Job 1:9, the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." This was a truly godly, good man who had all these awful things happen to us. And that teaches us a crucial lesson. No matter how blessed you are, no matter how good you are, no matter how godly you are, no matter how obedient to God you are, you're going to experience adversity in this world. This is true for two reasons. One is that we live in an evil world, and the other is that we have an enemy. Imagine that you take a friend who has never been to a water park before. You take this friend, say, down to Aquatica, down the SeaWorld water park down at Chula Vista. You go there and you look and you see these fun-looking rides. Everybody's out there in their, you know, swimwear, and they're going down these rides in the water, and it's very cool. And your friend says, "You know what? That looks like a lot of fun. I really want to go on these rides, but there's only one thing. I don't want to get wet." You don't want to get wet? You're at a water park. You're at a water park. If you go on rides at a water park, you're going to get wet. Well, here's bad news for you. The scripture says that Satan is now the god of this age. He's the guy who's causing a lot of the turmoil. The scripture says that this world has been affected by something that happened at the fall, that all of creation has been distorted and twisted and evil has been introduced into it. In other words, you and I, all of us, we live in evil world. Evil world. If you live in evil world, you're going to experience evil. That's how it is. There's no way around that. On top of that, to make it even worse, you have this enemy. In Job 1, verses 9 through 11, God had, we just saw, boasted of Job's great loyalty and character to Satan. And then Satan says this, "Well, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You've blessed the work of his hands so his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and surely he will curse you to your face." It's really important that we understand what Satan thinks. Do you see what he thinks? He says the only reason that someone would really worship God is that God gave them good stuff. God treats them really nice. And so they'll, you know, stay on God's good side. They'll worship him. But if God takes the good stuff away, They're not going to worship him. They'll hate him. That's what Satan thinks. That represents his true mindset. He thinks if he can just hit you hard enough, you will curse God. So guess what he's going to do? He's going to hit you as hard as he can, as often as he can. Because he is thoroughly convinced that is the thing that will make you fold like a house made of cardboard on a rainy day. Now, you may think this view of life is kind of dour. It's an evil world, and you got a Satan, enemy. Listen to 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12. Peter says, "Dear friends, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that has come upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening." You hear what he's saying? He's saying, you know, all the horrible things that happen to you, and you think, why is this happening to me? Peter says, well, that's what you ought to expect. That's how life is. It's not strange. That's life. Expect it. Well, this is great news. I came thinking how to deal with adversity, and so far it's just really bad. Okay. Look, there is good news. Job survived all of this. And that's the thing we need to see in this verse that we're talking about this morning, Job 13:15. Job, in the midst of it, displayed faith and perseverance. And you can see that throughout the book of Job. And Job chapter 1, verse 21, after all the first wave of horrible things happened to him, Job tore his robe and he shaved his head, symbols of grief. And he says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." Wow, what faith. I didn't come into this life with anything. I'm not going to go out with anything. And so if I have something or if I don't have anything, doesn't matter. What matters is that the name of the Lord be praised. And that verse gave rise to the great song that we often sing, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." I love that song, but I love the message even more. But Job wasn't done. In chapter 2, you know, he gets sick, like I mentioned, and his wife comes up with the curse God and die line. But once again, in verse 10, he replies, "Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" He's still trusting and loving God. And then we come to chapter 13. Added to his misery now, he's had all these terrible things happen. But now added to that, he's had some friends come along. And his friends for a week, they sat with him and they grieved with him. Good job. And then they got tired of grieving. You know, representative of what happens with people. "Now we're going to fix you." They said, "Well, Job, now we, you know, all this wallowing in misery, it's got to stop. We got to fix this." And so they began advising him about his grief. Oh boy. One of them, Zophar, says in chapter 11, verse 5, "Oh, how I wish that God would speak, that he would open his lips against you." Uh-oh. Why is all this happening to Job? It's Job's fault. God's out to get him. God needs to tell him, "Here's why this is happening, Job." Verse 11, chapter 11, Zophar says, "Surely he, God, recognizes deceitful men, and when he sees evil, does he not take note?" Who's he talking about? He's talking about Job. He's saying, this is why this is happening to you, Job, because God sees your evil. In verses 14 and 15, he says, "If you put away the sin that is in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, then you will lift up your face without shame." This is happening to you, Job, because you deserve it. Because you're so evil and God is out to get you. Wow. Isn't that great? Can you imagine? You're at the lowest point of your life. You are struggling and you're hurting. And your friend comes along and says, "Well, you know, this all happened because you suck." "Oh, thank you. You deserve it. Oh, thank you. This is all your fault." Yeah, that really helps. Job knows this is all wrong. He knows he hasn't done anything to deserve all of this. He's confused. He's mystified. God, why are you letting this happen? You know, are you asleep? You know, he's upset. He's confused. But he knows what Zophar is saying is absolutely wrong. Despite all that he's hearing from his friends, all that's happened, all he doesn't understand, in verse 15, he says, though God slay me, yet I will hope in him. I don't care if God goes to the final step of taking my life away. There is nothing that God can do that will ever stop me from worshiping him. That's what he's saying. Nothing will ever make me stop believing in my God and honoring him. Job would be confused. He would be hurt. He would feel mistreated. He would complain to God. He would argue with God. What he would never do is quit believing and quit worshiping. In Job 17:6, Job said, God has made me a byword to everyone, a man in whose face people spit. Wow, is that extreme? Well, might have been a little extreme. It is poetic, but it is also reflective of what he was actually experiencing. In his culture, the thinking went, and we see his friends going right down this track, God is just, so if something bad happens to you, it must be just. You must deserve it. And so when Job had more bad happen to him than anybody else, everyone in his culture is looking at him and saying exactly what Zophar said. That must be one really bad dude. He's really on God's bad side, and he deserves it. So in verse 7 of Job 17, Job says, my eyes grow dim with grief. And it sounds like he's about to give up. But in verse 9, he says, nevertheless, the righteous will hold to their ways. And so those with clean hands will grow stronger. Job says, in the midst of all of this, I'm not giving up. And in fact, I'm going to become stronger in my faith because of this. A few years ago, I told this story once. I was it was the end of a summer day, and I was going to drive home. Went out and I got in my car, and as I started up, this bee, a regular bee, came and it landed on the windshield of my car, right in front of my face. The bee right there. I thought, why would that bee land on glass? I don't know, but he's right there. But I thought, well, he's not going to be there long, because I'm going to drive out of here, and he's going to get blown off. So I started driving out of the parking lot that I was in. He just hung right in there. But I thought, well, that won't last long because I got onto the street and I'm going to be driving 30 miles an hour. And how's he going to stay on glass with a 30 mile an hour wind blowing against him? Well, he did. He just hung right there on my windshield, right in front of my face. I thought, this is really interesting. First of all, why does a bee want to be there anyway? You know, he's on glass. You know, there's no honey there. There's no reason for him to be there. And what's he hanging on to? It's slick. It's glass. And he's just hanging right there, right in front of my face. I thought, okay, dude, your time is up because I'm now going to get on the freeway. And so I started accelerating up the on-ramp, you know, 40 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour. I could see that bee just hanging in there. And by this time, you know, you're getting up to freeway speed, 60 miles an hour. I could see him just being buffeted by the wind. His wings are vibrating, and he's just hanging in there. And that thing would not let go. He's right there. And I got up to 65 miles an hour, and that bee is hanging right there. And I said, bee, you are crazy. And now it's getting dangerous because I'm on the freeway, and I'm looking at a bee instead of, you know. But I'm thinking, this is now kind of a challenge. So I said, I'm going to get you off my windshield, you know. So I started accelerating, get up to 70 miles an hour, and he's just hanging in there. Finally, about 75, it was like, off he went, you know, which was good because I was getting near ticket range. Anyway, I thought, you know, what a tenacious little animal. That thing, I have no idea why I thought it was so important to be on my windshield, but he was not letting go. He reminded me, you know, Jack Black, the comedian, had a band which he called Tenacious D. So I ever thought of that B from then on as Tenacious B, you know. He's not quitting. Well, Job is like that Tenacious B. I'm hanging on to God. I'm believing in him. And I'm going to honor him. And I will not let go. I don't care what happens to me. I'm not letting go. Ever. Okay. That's good. That's how we need to respond to adversity. Well, great. Nice. Thanks for the pep talk. Yeah, but how do you do that? Well, how do we have the kind of tenacity that Job displayed? Well, let me suggest several things that can help. First of all, we need to remember that perseverance is essential when we face adversity. You know, think about what if Job hadn't persevered? What if he had said, you know what, I have tried my best to serve God, and look where it got me. Either there is no God to trust because all this stuff happens, or he's a cruel God that would allow this to happen to me. He certainly doesn't care about me. Either way, I'm done. What if Job had done that? He would not be the only person in the history of the human race who's gone down that path. Here's the thing. Would he have ever had any impact on anyone else in this world if he'd done that? We're here thousands of years after the life of Job, reading about him, being inspired by him, being encouraged by him, being helped by his life because he persevered. You know, what if Job had lived a pleasant life and nothing had ever gone wrong? He was just a rich guy who was rich all of his life and everything went smoothly until the day he died. Would we learn anything from him? Would we be inspired by him? No, he'd just be another rich person that lived. We are inspired by him. We are helped by him. We are encouraged by him specifically because he went through such pain and persevered. James 1:2 says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds." When you face trials of many kinds. Now, please note that he did not write, "Consider it pure joy if you ever face trials." Lori and I just flew home last night from our vacation. And, you know, on the airplane, every time you get on a plane, they go through that routine. And we're at one point, you know, they talk about if the cabin loses pressure. You know, what if they were going through that and they said, "Now, when the cabin loses pressure..." Wait, when? What? No. If means it could happen, but it probably won't. When means, well, it's going to, and when it does, here's what you do. James doesn't say if you encounter trials. He says when you encounter trials. It will happen. So when you do, consider it joy. Okay. Well, why? Well, because this is how you become mature, complete. Proverbs 24:16, one of Lori's favorite verses, says, "For though the righteous fall seven times, they rise again." Why seven times? Well, because that, in their culture, seven was the symbol for totality, completeness, perfection. So what he's saying is, the righteous man totally fails, falls seven times, but he gets up and keeps going. He perseveres. Boy, I recall watching when our son Toby was learning how to surf. You know, if you watched him surf today, you'd say, "Wow, he's really a good surfer. He seems like he was, you know, a natural." He was not a natural. I remember taking him to the beach and watching him try to learn how to surf, and it was just fail, 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 fall, 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 hour after hour after day. It was like, this guy's never going to get this. The only way he was able to become a good surfer was by falling and falling and falling and falling and falling and just keeping at it. And the truth is, anything that you want to do in life that is worthwhile is going to involve that process of failing and falling and getting up and keep going. Every new job you take is going to involve some, initial, "I'm never going to be able to get this." You know, any new sport you take up, you try to take up a musical instrument, it's like, "Oh, it's overwhelming, I can't do it." You fail. You have to persevere. And that is as true of following Christ as it is of anything. Maybe more true. So, second thing I think we need to know is that perseverance, this perseverance that's so critical for us, requires more than just gritting our teeth, more than just saying, okay, I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to persevere. Here, what do we need to do? Well, first of all, we need to remember why perseverance is important. Remember the importance of perseverance. James says in verses 3 and 4 of chapter 1 in his book, "The testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking in anything." So the testing of your faith, the adversity, that's how you become mature. Now, the one time Lori and I were out on a walk, and we were actually talking about that verse, and she says, "Well, yeah, but what if someone says, I don't care about being mature, I care about being happy?" That's a really good question, because that's where the majority of human beings are. I don't want to be mature. Mature is not what drives me. I want to be happy. I want my life to feel good. Well, here's the thing you need to know about that. This idea of being mature, complete, could be translated whole. This is how you become whole as a human being. In other words, this is how you become healthy. This is how your soul becomes healthy. Why should you care? Well, here's the thing. If you're not whole and healthy, you are not going to be happy. So if you say, well, I don't care about being mature, I care about being happy, you have just decided that you're going to commit yourself to being unhappy. Because what you need is to become whole, and it's in your wholeness that you become happy. Well, how do we get that wholeness? Oh, here's the bad news. You persevere through adversity, through trials. Fame cannot make your soul healthy and whole. Money cannot make your soul healthy and whole. Pleasure cannot make your soul whole and healthy. Only God working in you as you persevere through adversity creates maturity, wholeness in your life. There's an obvious physical corollary. I want to be a healthy person. I want to have a healthy body. Okay. Well, what do you need to do? Well, by the way, I also want to feel good. Okay, if you want to feel good, avoid exertion at all costs, because that feels bad. You know, you sweat and you get tired and it hurts, and don't do that. And if you want to feel good, well, eat donuts for breakfast, pizza for dinner, ice cream cake for dessert, because that taste feels wonderful. And sit on the couch and, you know, use the remote to watch the flip channels. Have some potato chips while you're at it. Well, it'll feel good for a while. Will you have a healthy body? No. You'll destroy your health, and eventually you'll feel really bad as a result of it. How do you feel good? Well, you eat the right kinds of foods, and you have to exercise. Okay, well, I'll go out and I'll do that today, and then I'll be done tomorrow and go back to the ice cream. Day after day, you got to persevere in just doing the hard things. James says, that's how your soul becomes whole. I'm probably going to annoy some people by saying this, but if you pay attention to what James says, you'll see that all of the discipleship programs in the world that the churches are so, we often hear about, and everybody wants to get in a discipleship program, will never make your soul whole. You don't get that through a discipleship program. You get it through persevering through adversity. That's what James says. Not me, James, inspired by the Spirit of God. So, I want to be happy? Well, what you really want is you want to be whole. How do I get that? I persevere when things are hard, like Job did. So, remember that. That's critical for us to remember. Oh yeah, this is critical to my soul to be able to hang in there in hard times. So here's another thing you can do that will help you persevere. Give up fairness. Wait, what? God is just, so shouldn't we want justice in the world? Well, yes. But I want you to notice, if you think about the life of Job, the people who were so insistent on justice were actually his friends. It has to be just. It all has to figure out, you know, so that if something really bad happens to people, it's because they deserve it. That's what's just. And they got it totally wrong, didn't they? Isn't that an interesting thing? Ecclesiastes 8:14 says there, one of the things that really bothered the writer of that book was this. There is something else meaningless that occurs on earth. The righteous who get what the wicked deserve, and the wicked who get what the righteous deserve. And this too, I say, is meaningless. In other words, I look at the world and it doesn't balance. It doesn't work. Good people have bad things happen to them, and bad people have good things happen to them, and it just... Where's the justice of God in this? It doesn't work out. And so what happens to us is when bad things happen to us, we what do we say? It's not fair. Well, I don't deserve this. Well, so a couple of things we need to remember about that is really critical. One of those is if you're a parent, have you ever heard that expression, that's not fair, before? Oh, my goodness, with the kid. That's not fair. Yeah, and what's the parental response to that? Life's not fair. That's right. You got it. That's it. Man, who hasn't, as a parent, has not said that? You know, tough. Life's not fair, kid. Well, you know what? That's right. And part of the reason that's right is because what does a child mean when they say, that's not fair? They mean, I'm not getting what I want. Fair is, I get what I want. And if I don't, that's not fair. And we have the same problem. We go through life, we don't know fair. We don't know justice. We know, I want what I want, and if I don't get it, that's not fair. Call the ambulance, you know. We need to understand that and say, I don't know what's really fair ultimately in this world. Start with that. And then the second thing, and this is the more important one. This one's really, really important. You will never get this life to balance out in terms of justice, ever. Because God hasn't finished yet. If you leave eternity out of the equation, it won't balance. God is just, and justice will happen, but it won't always happen in this time frame. And so we have to understand that, okay, justice ultimately will be done, but it may not be done while I'm on this planet, in this life. And if I leave eternity out of the equation, then it's not going to work. So I need to quit worrying about fairness, and I need to trust God will make it all come out, and he may make that come out after I have died and left this planet. So let's let that go for now and stop saying, I deserve better. No, you don't. God knows what you deserve, and he will give you what you deserve, or really, he will give you what you don't deserve, which is his grace. Here's a third thing that we can do. We need to keep a clear focus. I once heard a researcher say that the two most excruciating pains that a human being can ever experience are passing a kidney stone and giving birth. Those are the two most painful experiences you can ever go through. Now, I hope I'll never have to pass a kidney stone, but the good news for me is I'll never have to give birth. Yahoo! So that's good. But I want you to think about the difference between those two experiences, passing a kidney stone, giving birth. Passing a kidney stone is the result of some malfunction. And something's gone wrong in the system. And so people who experience that typically say, I would give anything to never go through that again. Giving birth may be more painful, probably more painful, they say, is not a malfunction. It is a purposeful, intentional, creative act, a life-affirming act. And here's the interesting thing. Though it is more painful, as bad as it may be, time and again, women who undergo that experience will come to a place where they will say, I'm ready to do it again. No one ever says after passing a kidney stone, I'm ready to do it again. I'm ready for another one. What's the difference? One has a purpose, the other does not. You know, passing a kidney stone is just something you deserve. Survive. Hope I don't deserve it. Giving birth is something you do for a purpose. The key element in being able to be tenacious and survive and get through adversity is having a purpose in it. Job, back in chapter 2, verse 9, after Job's health failed and his wife asked him, are you still holding on to your integrity? Now, that's an interesting thing to say. When you think integrity, what does integrity have to do with it? She then says, well, curse God and die. So we know it has something to do with God, but what's the integrity part? Well, interesting, the Hebrew word for integrity meant simplicity or wholeheartedness. And so what she's really saying there is, are you still holding on to your wholeheartedness? And he was. Well, what was he wholehearted about? Well, Job had this undivided heart. In Job 16, verse 9, Job expressed his desire that God would just finish him off. You know, I'm just, okay, kill me, because this is so bad. But then in verse 10, he says, then I would still have this consolation, my joy and unrelenting pain, that I had not denied the words of the Holy One. Here's the thing that is most important to me, that I want more than anything else, that I would never deny God. That even if he kill me, I would still hope in him. Job said, the purpose that I want more than anything else is that I would believe in God and would honor him no matter what happens in my life. Hugely important message in this book. In the book of Job, you know, why did all those random things happen to Job? It wasn't that God was judging him. It wasn't that he deserved it. Far from it. It is that there was something going on that we, on this realm, couldn't even see. Something is happening in eternity, in the spiritual realm. There is a great contest going on. In his book, The Gospel According to Job, Mike Mason wrote, God's omnipotence is never in question in this fight. Like it or not, even Satan is compelled to bow before the throne of God. But what is being disputed in the battle on earth is God's moral right to omnipotence. Is God just? Is he good? Does he have the right to rule? Satan is saying he does not. And God is proving that he does. And that is the war that breaks out in all of the conflict that we see here on this planet. That is what is going on behind all of it. In his book, Disappointment with God, Philip Yancey wrote, why then is Job suffering? It's not for punishment. Far from it. He has been selected as the principal player in a great contest of the heavens. And what we need to remember when we are going through adversity is that's what's happening here. Will I stand in this and say, God has the right to rule? God has the right to rule in my life. And what I want more than anything else is that my life would say that God is good and God is to be trusted and I will hope in him no matter what. Lori and I, while we were on vacation, we went out to a restaurant. We were told, we got there and they said, oh, it's going to be 45 minutes before you can have a table. We went, okay, whatever, okay. So they gave you one of those little buzzer things, you know. We thought, well, rather than just sit around here, why don't we go and walk around, look at some of the shops close by. So So we walked out of the restaurant. We were walking down the street, and two doors down, there's another restaurant. And we happened to stop there, and we started chatting with this gal who was a hostess who's standing right there at the entrance of the restaurant. And she said, oh, you should come eat here. You know, this is with great restaurant. You know, we said, oh, yeah, we're waiting for there, 45-minute wait. And she said, oh, well, we can seat you right away. And she said, here, look at the menu. And so we're looking at the menu. And the menu was very similar to the restaurant we were going to go to. And we thought, you know, maybe we should do this. We just go in here and eat, you know, and they have a place. You have a great view. This is good. And the menu's so similar, you know. And so we're thinking, maybe we should do this. And so Lori asked a key question. She says to the little hostess gal, who was very friendly, said, so what's your favorite? What do you recommend off the menu? And the gal says, well, I'm a vegan, so I don't eat any of the food at the restaurant. We went back to the other restaurant. You're telling us it's a great restaurant, but you won't eat here at the place where you work? I'm not buying this at all. When we go through adversity and we respond by saying, I don't know if I can trust God. How could God let these things happen to me? We are essentially saying, I'm not eating at God's restaurant. Yeah, I'll recommend it to somebody else, but I'm not eating it myself. That's what we say, not only to people we know, but to the unseen world around us, where there's this great contest going on. When we, like Job, say, I don't care what happens, I will never stop believing in my God, we make a loud statement that our God has the right to be omnipotent, and he is good. So, last thing then, we need to look to Jesus. Look to him, first of all, to know he is the sovereign ruler of all. He is the one who is actually able to use something as horrifying, as unjust as the cross, something as bad as the cross, as in fact the key component to his plan to bring about the best thing that's ever happened to anyone, salvation of the human race. God takes bad and makes good out of it. He's sovereign even in those things, so we need to look to him to recognize, oh yeah, that's right. It may look bad right now, it may feel bad, and it may be bad, but somehow God is sovereign and will make this work for good. Also, when we look to Jesus, I think we need to remember this. Romans 15:5 describes God as the God who gives encouragement and endurance. God is the one we can look to give us strength to keep going in those difficult times. You know, you think about Paul and all those terrible things that he went through, and you think, how did he survive all the trials and the beatings and the imprisonments and all of the stuff? Well, Paul says, God is the God who gives encouragement and endurance. God made me able to do it. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind, and God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear, but when you are tempted, he will provide a way out so that you can endure it. God will give you the way to stand and hang in there and be that tenacious bee. Tony Dungy, the former Super Bowl winning head coach, relates a story that verifies this in his book, Quiet Strength. Trent Dilfer is a former quarterback and the NFL also won a Super Bowl. Now he's often on ESPN. And he's a follower of Jesus. Well, Trent and his wife went through a parent's nightmare when their 5-year-old son, Trevin, died. In his book, Dungy says, I remember calling Trent and telling him that we were praying for him. And I told him that I was certain I would not be able to handle the death of a child with the kind of grace and courage Trent had shown. His answer was immediate and direct. You could, coach, if you had to. The Lord will give you the strength at that time to go through it. Well, Dungy at that time just thought, I don't see how that's possible. Well, a few years later, Tony Dungy's son committed suicide. He wrote, after his son Jamie died, he said, when Jamie died, I realized that Trent was right. God's strength is sufficient. God gave him the ability to endure the most painful thing a parent could ever endure. God gives endurance and encouragement if we will trust in him. So like Job, we should look to him and say, though he slay me, yet I will hope in him. Let's pray. Father, we don't like adversity. You know that. We like a day at the beach, sunshine. And we hate it when the wind starts blowing and we start getting sandblasted. Help us to remember, Lord, that we live in a world where the winds are going to blow. It's not a surprise. We should not be caught off guard. We should expect it. We may not enjoy it. But help us to remember the truths we've seen this morning. That ability to persevere and to be tenacious and trust in you in the midst of even the most difficult things is critical. It's critical to our purpose in life of bringing glory to you, and it's critical to our souls becoming whole. So help us, Lord, to remember that truth, to look to you for the strength to endure, and to, with Job, then say, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, but blessed be the name of the Lord. Amen.